Understanding Revolution and Revolutionaries, Case Study 2. Last week, we looked at the French Revolution. And this week, we look at the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. And notice I call it the Bolshevik Revolution, not the Russian Revolution, because Alexander Solzhenitsyn rebuked us all who, in our ignorance and foolishness, called it the Russian Revolution. He said it was not a Russian Revolution. It was an anti-Russian Revolution. Russians were the victims. And so, quite right, what a slander to the poor Russians that the people who lost so many tens of millions of their own people to these Bolsheviks should be called the Russian Revolution. It's like blaming the victim. So I took the rebuke quite rightly, and we call it the Bolshevik Revolution. The Reformation Society has for 14 and a half years been looking at issues in history and in doctrine, always with a view to how we can make a better world today, and specifically over the last 2.5 years, also seeking to provide the other side to journalism. So as we are facing so many riots today, so much violence, and so many youngsters in particular in university seem absolutely infatuated with communism and revolution and the terms of revolution and all the dialectics of Marxism, economic determinism, dialectical materialism, atheism, evolutionism, all these things that go along with it, social Darwinism, we need to understand what revolutions are like, because 30 years ago we defeated communism in the Cold War, the Berlin Wall came down, but we need to remember there's a whole generation that's grown up since then who don't know about what those of us brought up in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, 90s took for granted. So, first of all, Russia, this phenomenal empire, the largest country on earth, the largest empire at that time, continuous empire, that is. And you can see the growth of Russia, how it grew from the time of Peter the Great through Ivan the Terrible, well, Ivan the Terrible first, Peter the Great, all the way through to Tsar Nicholas II. And they took the Orthodox gospel all the way across, all the way to the Pacific Ocean, across a continent, from Europe across Asia. And the Russian Empire was actually the most multicultural, multilingual empire in the world. No other empire of continuous population was on the same flag with so many different peoples. And you can see from 1613 in particular, time of Peter the Great, through to 1914, they took a vast amount of territory, and that was a very brave, courageous operation, many of the times fighting the Mongols, fighting the Huns, fighting Muslim forces, and getting the Tatars and many others to get all the way over to Vladivostok and Kamchatka. In fact, many people forget they even had Alaska. And my understanding had always been how backward Russia was. And in fact, I've learned recently that that's been greatly exaggerated, because we should understand this. After the Mugabe revolution in Zimbabwe, there was a concerted attempt to denigrate, debase, defile, distort the history of Rhodesia in order to, in some way, distract one from the absolute total failure of Marxism in Zimbabwe. And they've done the same with South Africa. You must exaggerate the problems of the past. You must invent and ignore anything positive. And I'm afraid that's been done of the Russians. And it wasn't just that the Tsar was assassinated, but they've been character assassinated. Russia, back in the early part of the 20th century, was a phenomenal country and a growing country. And it's a lie to say that Tsar Nicholas was an absolute ruler with no restraints by law or parliament. Here in January 1906, he is consecrating the Russian Duma, the lowest of two houses. This is the House of Legislature, the Duma, the parliament, and there was the Senate as well. And progressively over the next years, they took more and more power away from the Tsar to such an extent that by 1917, they compelled him to abdicate. Now, how can one say he was a dictator with absolutely no rule of law and without any elected representatives when they had the Duma and they had the Senate? And here is the Tsar opening it in 1906. Here is a picture of the Tsar in front of the Duma, where they are sitting, making laws, the Duma in session. And in 1913, there was a phenomenal nationwide celebration of 300 years of the Romanovs. And some of this is available on film footage. A bit jumpy because they were hand-cranked films at that stage. They didn't have electricity out there for these filmmakers. But the pictures are there are absolutely astounding to see what the Romanovs had accomplished. And taking from a book by our good friend Stephen Mitford Goodson, A History of Central Banking and the Enslavement of Mankind, he points out that Russia was the only major country and empire in the world without a Rothschild bank, without a central bank. Russia had her own state bank, and in fact, Tsar Alexander I at the Council of Vienna, Congress of Vienna, expressly refused every attempt by Nathan Mayer Rothschild to intimidate him, as he succeeded with all the other countries in Europe, to accept a Rothschild-run bank, central bank, where they would loan money to the government, which would then be paid off at colossal interest, which would basically enslave the populations to endless higher and higher and higher taxes. And so he points out that, in fact, Mayor Nathan Rothschild actually threatened him and said, I will destroy your family. And in fact, it has been documented by the Russians that the last five czars all died young and all died of assassination and all from the same cause. This is the state bank at the Russian Empire, and the Russian bank managed to lend out money to people without interest. They had a small service charge, handling charge, but it was insignificant. So, for example, Russia had the lowest national debt in the world. So, for example, taken in terms of millions of rubles, France had a debt of 288 million, Great Britain 169 million, Germany 135 million, and Russia only 58 million. Despite being the largest country in Europe, they had less debt than any other country. And only 2% of their debt was abroad. And interestingly, to see that the total length of the railway lines was over 100,000 kilometers of railways. I thought Russia was so backward that they didn't have railways most of the place. Not so. Also, 1861, Tsar Alexander II abolished serfdom, set the serfs free, and in fact, by the time that 1914 came by, 80% of the arable land in Russia was in the hands of the peasants. They managed to give, by 1913, 2 million families, previous peasants, owned their own land and were able to borrow money. And so they say that there was over 19 million acres, or 7.6 million hectares, which was owned by peasants in Russia. Now, the lie I'd picked up from my school textbooks was that the peasants didn't own any land under the Tsar and that Lenin gave them the land. In fact, it's exact opposite. The Tsar gave them land and they could borrow money on it. They could take out loans on their no-interest loans on the land that they now owned and entitled to. And Lenin took away the land from them and threw them into collectives. So it's exactly the opposite than what we've been put. How do you like this interest? That the, if you just go back to the peasant state bank, the peasant state bank was described at that time as the greatest social benefit organization, institution of land credit in the world, and was praised by President Taft of America at the time as the most enlightened economic policy in the world. So 30% of the population had been set free in 1861 by the setting free of the serfs by Tsar Alexander II, who was assassinated, of course. The agricultural production in Russia was so high that they were the world's breadbasket. They actually were producing 42% of the world's barley, 30% of the world's oats, 67% of the world's rye, and 31% of the world's wheat. Now, this is a revelation to me, considering all of my lifetime, Russia's never been able to feed itself, and they've always needed American and Canadian grain and wheat and so on, and vast amounts of Western aid to just keep them afloat, and every winter they're all about to die of starvation without massive amounts of Western aid. And to hear that, in fact, they were producing more cereals than the combined production of the United States of America, Argentina, and Canada combined. Do you know that Russia owned more than half of all the horses in the world? There are more horses in Russia than the rest of the world combined in 1914. So it's an extraordinary thing. Russia had the lowest taxes of any country in the Western world. So Great Britain pad, taking it in percentage-wise, Great Britain, you paid 10% of your income in state taxes and 16% in local taxes. So you were paying 26% taxes in Britain. And by the way, you also had 13% indirect taxes. We know what indirect taxes are. You're paying taxes on tax. When you're buying petrol, most of the price of the petrol is actually taxes and other levies added to that. So indirect taxes. Germany, the combined taxes of state and local was 12%. France, combined total was 12%. Austria, combined total was 10%. Russia, combined total was 2%. 2.6% precisely. So they had just over 1% in state tax, just over 1% in local taxes. Indirect taxes, they were at 5.9%, let's say 6%, while Britain's indirect tax was 13 to almost 14%. Germany was over 9%. France over 16%. Austria is over 11%. So Russia had the lowest taxation in the world. Now, that's actually quite amazing. What's also amazing is they had the largest gold supplies in the world. No country had more gold than Russia. So Russia managed to have in their state bank 1,550 tons of gold, which is more than the Bank of France, more than the Reichsbank in Germany and France combined, and much more than the Bank of England, which had 331 tons. That's interesting. Also the fact that they abolished slave child labor 100 years before Great Britain. And when you look at all the different aspects here, you can see Russia had the lowest national debt in the world. They had the highest agricultural production in the world. They had the lowest direct taxes in the world. And they had the lowest indirect taxes in the world. All this is straight out of A History of Central Banking and Enslavement of Mankind by Stephen Mitford Goodson, who was once director of the Southern Reserve Bank. And they had the largest gold reserves by far in the world, all of which was looted during the Bolshevik Revolution. Russia came from a very peasant background, but they were very advanced by the beginning of the 20th century. And those of you who've seen any Leo Tolstoy, War and Peace, or you've got some understanding of some of the great classics of Russia, maybe you've gotten a bit of an inkling from Dr. Zhivago or Nicholas and Alexandra. But just look at some of these pictures of Moscow, and you can get an idea of a tremendous civilization. And this is a painting of the black and white picture I showed just now of the opening of the Duma in Russia, in St. Petersburg. Remember, St. Petersburg was the capital. The communists made Moscow the capital. But the marriage of Nicholas and Alexandra, and state events. One thing that's very striking is that while Nicholas had quite a sad upbringing from his mother was a princess of Denmark, but she had lost two of her sisters, had died in her childhood. And so there was quite a lot of sadness in his household, but that couldn't be said about Nicholas and Alexandra's household. They had a very happy family, and all the evidence is very strong on that. The oldest was Olga, second oldest Tatiana, Maria, Anastasia is probably the most famous, the youngest, and Alexei, the youngest daughter was Anastasia, but the youngest of all was Alexei, who was heir to the throne. And just every picture you see, you can see a very strong family. One of the things that is quite fascinating about the royal family in Russia is how they're so similar to the royal family in Britain and Germany, because, in fact, Tsar Nicholas was a grandson of Queen Victoria, as was Kaiser Wilhelm II, as was King George V. They were all first cousins. They're all grandchildren or grandsons of Queen Victoria. And you can notice there was this absolute obsession with dressing their children in sailor outfits. That was the fashion in Britain, in Germany, and in Russia at the same time. And Olga, the oldest, Tatiana, and Maria, and then Anastasia, the youngest. And the mother as well. Now, of course, bear in mind that generally speak at this stage, people did not smile for photos, and you had to hold your expression for the same time. The mother doesn't look very happy here, but in fact, she was plainly a very loving mother. They apparently had an extremely loving household, and they had a very happy family. And the fact that they were all together to the very end is testimony of that. Tsar Nicholas has also been depicted as a weak ruler and as a failure of a monarch in even sympathetic films like Nicholas and Alexander, but that's not fair to the history when you look at it. He did some very decisive reforms. There was phenomenal growth. He did a lot of strengthening of the country. He resisted a lot of bad advice. He took a lot of decisive actions. And some people might interpret his quiet Christian faith, his humility, and his meekness as weakness. But the fact that he was a meek Orthodox Christian, now bear in mind, if he was a Calvinist, he would have been more aggressive, because Calvinism and Protestant teaching in general encourages you to be more assertive and aggressive. But the Orthodox teachings very much encourages meditation, humility, submission, your duty, yes, but it's not as outward focused as the Protestant Reformation has made its adherents. So a Protestant would tend to be the most active in social issues. Catholics, much less so. You know, just be quiet, kneel, open your mouth, take the wafer, that sort of thing. But the Orthodox Church was very into personal devotion. And Tsar Nicholas was a very devout Christian. There's no doubt by the Orthodox standard. In fact, the Orthodox Church has made him a saint. His entire family, they are the epitome of what an Orthodox Christian family are meant to be. He even forgave his murderers and executioners ahead of time. He is not a man who held grudges. He is a gracious person. And the fact that he was courageous and that he was quiet and accepting of his fate does not make him a weak person. Even though I think if he was a Calvinist, he would have reacted differently. But bear in mind, he was brought up in an Orthodox church. They had the Cossacks, great cavalry forces. They had a lot of foot soldiers. And bear in mind, the First World War was the first serious war where soldiers didn't march the whole way to the front, where they actually went a lot of the way by train. Because before that, for example, do you know the soldiers who fought at Isandlwana and Rooik's Drift landed in Cape Town and marched all the way from Cape Town to Zeeland? They walked the whole way. There was no transportation for them. And that wasn't unusual. Before the First World War, soldiers were expected to sail and then walk, march to their destinations. None of this coming in by air business. They were foot soldiers. And to think that the 24th Regiment, who got wiped out at Isandlwana, they walked all the way from Cape Town to Zeeland to get taken out by Zulus. The Russians had a phenomenal artillery. In fact, it's quite staggering when you see the massive amount of artillery that they actually had in time for the First World War. They mobilized 5 million soldiers. It just boggles the brain. And after a while, I think it got up to 9 million. But the Russian winter of 1916 into 1917, remember their winter in the Northern Hemisphere is the opposite time of ours in Africa, was one of the coldest in memory, and people were freezing. On the 23rd of February, which is by the old-style Russian calendar, it's the 8th of March by our Western calendar, makes people confused because they celebrate the February Revolution in March, and they celebrate the October Revolution in November, but that's because the calendars were out of sync at one stage. This is in 1917. 90,000 textile workers went on strike. That was International Women's Day, 23rd of February. By the next day, half of the industrial workers in St. Petersburg were on strike, and by the third day, the number had risen to almost 250,000. The continual string of military defeats in the First World War, the chronic shortage of food, and perhaps most importantly, the lack of fuel for cooking and heating, led to what was called the women's strike, although far more men were involved. Riots broke out, people were killed, shops were looted, mostly food shops. On the 26th of February, Russian calendar, the striking workers began to move to the city center, and St. Petersburg's built on a network of islands crisscrossed with canals built by Peter the Great, who wanted to have a western-faced capital looking out towards the rest of Europe through this port city. And so it's called the Venice of the North in many ways, a network of islands crisscrossed with canals. Well, the soldiers closed the bridges, but on a cold winter like that, they could just walk across the rivers because they were iced over anyway. Whole military units began to mutiny as they were ordered to fire on the crowds. And they said, nope, they're not interested. And they start to march with the rioters instead of against them. The Volensky regiment refused the order of the commander and shot the commander. They went over to the revolution. Now, this is the February Revolution. All that's happening in March. Alarmed by the shocking news of riots and mutiny in his capital, Tsar Nicholas set out from the front, which is something like 500 miles away, to return to his capital. But railway workers stopped the royal train at Pskov station, 170 miles from St. Petersburg. And he was delayed and he was derailed, effectively. There he received news of the mutiny of the Volensky regiment. General Kabalov reported that the whole city of St. Petersburg was in the hands of revolutionaries, including the railway stations, the telephone exchange, and the artillery garrison. Now you may ask, are these the Bolsheviks? Is this Lenin? No, Lenin's nowhere near the place. Lenin is in Zurich. Trotsky, he's in New York in the Bronx. The Bolsheviks aren't involved. In fact, the Bolsheviks had even said just at a meeting in Zurich with socialists just a short while before, Lenin had said, it is impossible that there will be a Bolshevik revolution in our lifetime. And so he was even telling people, not going to happen. And so who were the people doing this? Well, it was socialists. They were the Mensheviks. And the Bolsheviks had broken away from the Mensheviks because the Mensheviks were apparently too compromising in their mind already back in 1903. So at one stage, Lenin was part of the Mensheviks. Now he is a Bolshevik. But they're all socialists. The differences between how far left each one was. So this was a socialist revolution, but it was not a communist revolution in the sense of Bolshevik yet. All government ministers were arrested. On the eighth day of his being delayed at this railway station, the Tsar abdicated under pleas from every one of his military and government leaders. And he said, to save Russia and to keep the army at the front, I decided on the step and I left Pskov with heavy feelings. Around me was treason, cowardice, and deceit. And that's what he wrote about that experience. He could not have known that that abdication was the end of the monarchy and the end of Romanov rule. He had every expectation that his brother, Michael, would take over and would continue. But Michael refused. He didn't want the responsibility. And in fact, the anti-monarchist feeling was a bit too deep. The 300-year authority and reputation of the Romanov Tsars had been squandered in a hopeless war, which had brought nothing but defeat, despite phenomenal sacrifice. Millions of Russian soldiers had died, and millions had been captured or had surrendered, and they were still being thrown into this meat grinder. And the thing that's so heartrending about this is the Tsar had actually rejected the offer of the Kaiser back in 1915 for a separate peace, because Russia had suffered terrible losses on the Eastern Front. Battle of Tannenberg, two whole Russian armies were defeated and captured, and there were so many battles after that, that while they had a few victories against Austro-Hungarian forces, they had such a string of defeats against the German Imperial Army. And so in 1915, the Kaiser offered a separate peace, which made all the sense in the world to Russia. If he had accepted that in 1915, he probably would have kept the empire, kept the Romanovs in place. Russia would have continued to be a constitutional monarchy. But by continuing to fight, and he did it because he felt a loyalty to his allies, the French, the Serbians, and the British. Little did he know that when he needed sanctuary, his cousin in Britain would allow himself to be bullied into refusing to accept him to come into exile in Britain, where he and his family could have been safe. While King George V, the Emperor of the British Empire, instantly said, yes, you're welcome to come. He had a visit from Lord Rothschild of the Bank of England, said, you can't let this man come to Britain. And whatever pressure was brought to bear, the British king, King George V, then reversed his invitation and no longer allowed the royal family to come to them, which would have made sense. They were cousins. This is a grandson of Queen Victoria, for goodness sakes. So how tragic. And by the way, I've got this picture up here just to show. You can see these are cousins. That is King George V. That is Tsar Nicholas, and that is Kaiser Wilhelm. And honestly, they all are so obviously related. It's uncanny, and sometimes you can't easily tell them apart, especially in some of the pictures when they're wearing one another's uniform. So you'll get the Tsar in a German uniform and the Kaiser in a Russian uniform, and you'll see King George in a German uniform, and because they'd all been made generals and marshals of one another's armies, and they'd swapped uniforms. And so you can't even tell from the uniform sometimes. At least the Kaiser had a moustache and not a beard. But when it comes to Tsar Nicholas and King George V, you could be forgiven for mistaking them. Millions would have been spared a violent death if he had accepted that separate peace in 1915. And so this was the way the New York Herald reported the Tsar of Russia abdicates. And to be honest, all the Allies rejoiced at this news. The Americans, who weren't in the war yet, thought this is wonderful, because the American press had this inbuilt bent that every revolution is like the American War of Independence, and they've got this inbuilt anti-monarchy mentality in the press. And so the idea was, this is great, this is wonderful, freedom's coming. Soviet Union's going to be like another America, you know, freedom and liberties for all. And the British and the French were excited, thinking this is wonderful because the new government will maybe pursue the war more effectively. So there was such short-sightedness on every side. At the Taurid Palace in St. Petersburg, a provisional government was put together by representatives of the Imperial Parliament, the Duma. The provisional government of the Duma abolished the death penalty. At the very time, it might have done some good. And dismantled the Tsarist police at the very time they needed them the most. Defund the police? Dismantle the police? Sound familiar? Does this ring any bells? They agreed their priority was to meet the obligations to the military allies and to get the Russian armed forces back into the war. What were they thinking? This decision proved fatal. The army and the population general were sick and tired of the war. They'd had it for over 2 years. They were sick of it, and they were going nowhere. They had had 36 months of this. How on earth could you expect them to continue to fight? They weren't winning. They were just losing. The country had been bankrupted, impoverished by this ruinous war. The government had completely misread the mood of the population. In another wing of the same Taurid Palace, a rival political organization was being set up. It was calling itself the Soviet, which basically means a kind of committee. They perceived that the key element was peace at any price. And in this sense, the Bolsheviks were spot on. They recognized what all the Russian people want is peace. Peace at any price, peace no matter what. The worst thing is to continue this mindless, worthless, unwinnable war. The Petrograd Soviet issued order number one, putting elected committees in charge of army units. And many soldiers and sailors interpret this as a license to go home. So adios, and off they were, walking home. Millions just deserted. Even as the provisional government was promising to keep Russia in the war, the army just melted away. And you get a very powerful scene in Dr. Zhivago, where this one unit is marching to the front and this other one is drifting back from the front. And as this well-disciplined force is trying to march, and the deserters are sort of pulling them aside and away, and the whole thing starts to melt, and the officer's trying to get some order amongst the men. Next thing, he gets shot by one of these deserters, and then the whole thing descends into chaos. This is pretty much what was going on. Millions of peasants in uniform, sullen, angry, sick of the wasted lives and squandered sacrifices, wanted an end to the never-ending series of military defeats, and being cold, and being wet, and being hungry, and having eight soldiers expect to eat out of one bowl, and things like this. The situation was absolutely unacceptable. And so, while expected to march to the front, most were already turning for home. Guchkov, the Minister of War, remarked bitterly, "The provisional government does not possess any real power. Its directives are carried out only to the extent that it's permitted by the Soviet. All the essential elements of real power, the troops, the railroads, the post, the telegraphs, are all in their hands." And so this unpopular parliament was committed to a ruinous war and therefore found itself powerless. Nobody wanted to obey them because their policies were obviously destructive. So initially, the Allies, France, Britain, the USA, had welcomed the revolution in Russia, thinking it would improve Russia's contribution to the war. The German High Command also was elated. I mean, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so they offered free passage home to the most dangerous revolutionary exiles they could find, hoping to destabilize the enemy on the Eastern Front still further. Because Germany was fighting on four fronts. They were not only fighting on the Western Front, Belgium and France. They're fighting Southern Front with Italy. They're fighting at the Southeastern Front against Romania. And so obviously for them, this to get the Eastern Front stabilized would have released soldiers for the Western Front, maybe an end to the war. And so from Zurich, put in a sealed train, Lenin was taken sealed so that he couldn't get out, because then you can't let this plague bacillus, this bubonic plague, out in our country. Let him travel over by ferry to Sweden, travel across Sweden, ended up from the Finland station, St. Petersburg. And so Lenin managed to make it all the way back to Russia, hopefully to cause trouble, which he did. So Vladimir Lenin came to be put in a sealed train from Zurich across Germany, arriving at Petrograd's Finland station early April 1917, just as America was getting itself involved in this worthless war as well. Lenin's train was welcomed at the Finland station by a band playing La Marseillaise, because no one had yet learned the tune of the Internationale, which is the socialist anthem of the Bolsheviks and Mensheviks. So he got the French Revolution song. His speech from the top of an armored car was to the point. Let us end the war. Lots of cheers. Let the workers take power now. But this shocked his comrades, because all the comrades were committed to the war. Lenin was a bit exceptional in this case, because he is against the war. When Vladimir Lenin returned to Russia, he had been in exile for most of the previous 17 years, running one wing of the small, quarrelsome Russian Socialist Democratic Party, otherwise known as the Mensheviks. His Bolsheviks were the radical left-wing faction of the Marxist Party. In fact, as Trotsky summarized it, Lenin tells us what tells the Politburo what it's decided, the Politburo tells the party what it's decided, and in this way, the people know what they've decided. And then when he challenged, have I interpreted you correct? And Lenin says, you have the right to disagree with me, and I've got the right to shoot you for disagreeing with me. So there we go. That, you know, the people shall rule means the party shall rule, which means the Politburo shall rule, which actually means the dictator in charge shall rule. So Lenin had split from the more conciliatory socialist Mensheviks back in 1903 already. And this is one of these upper room meetings in Zurich. As has been said, both Christianity and communism started with a handful of disciples in the upper room. It's, you know, for good or ill, it's a small group of dedicated people that make history. Lenin found the Marxists in Russia arguing over what to do next. Well, he recognized immediately what you need to do. He wanted peace. Well, his own party paper, Pravda, or Truth, attacked him. You know, how can you be so unpatriotic as to say we've got to end the war before we've had victory? But Lenin had read the mood of the people in the streets. His slogans of peace, bread, land, all power to the Soviets came just in time to mobilize the masses to support the Bolshevik cause. The people would have supported the Duma and the Provisional Parliament if they had moved for peace, which of course had been offered to them many a time since 1915 anyway. And considering they had not a snowball's chance in hell of winning, why on earth would you not accept peace? Why must you keep throwing good money after bad? Why must more and more millions of people die? So in this sense, Lenin read the but don't think he is a peaceful person. He was just a politician, and he saw what he needed to do to get to power. The Socialist Revolutionary Party had a commanding position in the provisional government. One of their members, a young lawyer, Alexander Kerensky, was the prime minister of Russia. And by the way, Kerensky had one time been a friend of Lenin. He was also deputy chairman of the Petrograd Soviet, so you'd have thought Kerensky's in an unassailable position. However, Kerensky still believed in continuing to fight the war, and this cost him all of his support. So in June, Kerensky ordered a fresh offensive against Germany, and it was a disaster. In 3 weeks, 60,000 more Russian soldiers had died. Why? Why do you need any more people to die before you realize this is hopeless? General Knox, head of the British military mission in Russia, wrote that the Russian army was irretrievably ruined as a fighting organization. which meant there's no hope of getting them back in the field to fight any kind of campaign again. There was an explosion of popular rage in the streets, with furious demonstrations from war-weary soldiers, hungry families, frustrated citizens, impatient for peace and protesting against the war. Vast numbers were unemployed due to factories being closed, and all the while the Bolsheviks were busy agitating. Banners began to appear on the streets: peace, bread, land, all power to the Soviets. Of course, they didn't get any of those things that was offered to them, but that was what was being promised. Kerensky now clamped down on political freedom and arrested so many Bolsheviks that Lenin shaved off his beard and fled with false papers to Finland, where he spent the rest of the summer writing a book. And here's an actual picture showing Lenin without his beard, so we can see what he actually looked like without a beard. And there's a picture depicting him without a beard, presumably in Finland during that time when the Bolsheviks had to flee. Again, the history book saying that Kerensky never cracked down on freedom of speech isn't true. He just did it a bit late. The Supreme Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, General Kornilov, attempted a military coup which collapsed in ignominy, and Kerensky sacked General Kornilov, and the credibility of the provisional government was now exhausted. They hadn't done anything good, right, effective yet. And on the street, the people declared all the provisional governments of the socialist revolutionaries had succeeded in doing was putting up train fares. And it was true, because it doesn't matter how good your intentions are, what have you actually achieved as a government? And since they took over from the Tsar, they hadn't actually succeeded in doing anything aside from putting up fares. The government admitted over 2 million soldiers had deserted from the front. It was much more than that, but that's what they admitted. And 3 million had died so far. That's a loss of 5 million men. They started the war with 5 million men. Of course, more had been put into the meat grinder since, but what country can survive that? Collectively, that's more than the total population of the greater Cape Peninsula. I mean, just think of the loss of life this represents for any civilization. Lenin was delighted. "Never underestimate the power of constructive chaos," he exclaimed. Now, bear in mind, communists are atheists who believe in economic determinism and dialectical materialism. And as atheists, they believe in evolution. Once upon a time, there was nothing, and then there was something, and something became everything. And a huge explosion created everything, and therefore, if you can just blow up enough things and burn down enough things, paradise will come about. So the mentality of the people in the streets, if you want to understand the revolutionaries in the streets, you've got to understand it from an evolutionary social Darwinism point of view. They are absolutely convinced that burning and looting and destroying is good. Just like the Big Bang created everything, they're going to produce utopia through chaos. It's social Darwinism. If you can believe in evolution, it's not much of a stretch to believe that communism could make a better world. As the Socialist Revolutionary Party and the Mensheviks' revolution dissolved into failure, the Bolshevik Central Committee, the BCC, prepared for insurrection. The capital was full of deserters and street crime. And the Tsar's palace at Zarko Selo was looted by mobs. Officers at the naval base of Kronstadt were lynched by the men. The sailors lynched their own officers. The new commander-in-chief, General Alexeyev, resigned on the grounds he no longer had an army to lead. It was just a mob. And here you can see the red-banded Bolsheviks walking through the streets, pulling one of these heavy machine guns on the ground. At this point, a well-funded Leon Trotsky, or Levi Bronstein, to use his correct name, returned from exile in the Bronx of New York with a band of Jewish revolutionaries from America who formed the vanguard of the Red Army. Now, in all of his time in the Bronx, he earned about $500. But he declared several hundred thousand dollars in cash to the Canadian border as he prepared to cross from Canada across the Atlantic to Europe. And he arrived with millions. And in fact, it's been documented by Professor Anthony Sutton in Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution that Chase Bank provided millions to the Bolsheviks through Leon Trotsky, or Levi Bronstein, and that's why he had no shortage of money for everything from the beginning. Isn't it interesting that biggest revolutionaries who turned Russia upside down weren't even in Russia when the revolution began? One came from America, the other came from Zurich, New York and Zurich. By October 1970, the Bolsheviks were publishing 25 newspapers. Now, publishing newspapers, even today, is an extremely expensive operation, more so then. And the Bolsheviks lacked no money. And it's been well documented by Professor Anthony Sutton's book, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution and the Best Enemy Money Can Buy, that they were pouring in. One of the men, Armand Hammer, who is a colossal capitalist, his father was the Secretary General of the Communist Party USA. And so, as Anthony Sutton said, as an investigator, I found at the top capitalists and the communists are one. There's not just an interlock. Said they're the same people in many cases, in the same family. And so the Bolsheviks had 25 newspapers, and soon the membership soared to 40,000 because they lacked no money. They had all the weapons they needed. They had vast amounts of money. They could print anything they wanted. So Lenin now arrived back from his hideaway in Finland and declared, "History will not forgive us if we do not take power now." On the 25th of October by the old Russian calendar, or 7 November by the Western calendar, the Bolshevik soldiers, sailors, workers began occupying railway stations, telephone exchanges, and post offices. They also seized the state bank, which had the largest hoard of gold on earth, and the Winter Palace. And this classic picture of one of these Bolsheviks with his red band in the throne room of the palace just gives you some of an idea of what's been achieved or what's been destroyed. The mob of insurrectionists stormed into the cabinet room of the provisional government and declared the provisional government is deposed. They arrest them all. But Prime Minister Kerensky fled to the front to rally resistance while the rest of the cabinet ministers were arrested. Interestingly, Kerensky survived. He lived in exile, died in 1970, and he had a chance, but because of his sense of loyalty to France and to Britain, he believed they had to keep Russia in a war and therefore basically doomed Russia to this foolish war. Lenin simply declared, "We shall now proceed to construct the socialist order." Now, the new government was called the Council of People's Commissars. So they replaced the Tsar with the Commissars. At this stage, there was only two Bolsheviks for every 300 Russians. The Bolsheviks were a miniature minority. They were nothing close to a majority, but this is the way it works. Every revolution is run by a very small minority. They nationalized the factories. They legalized divorce. They declared themselves the first domino of an international proletarian revolution that could change the world. I think that may surprise people to know that the term domino comes from the Russians themselves. We are the first domino of an international proletarian revolution that'll change the world. The first elections for Democratic Constituent Assembly was deemed a failure because the Bolsheviks only won a quarter of the seats. So, when delegates assembled in January 1918, the Red Guards closed the session, forced all elected delegates out of the hall, barring the doors, and therefore Russia's long-awaited parliament lasted less than a day, never reconstituted. That's it, last elections ahead for the next 70 years. Freedom of the press was severely restricted. Anyone labeled as an enemy of the people was arrested and dealt with severely, often execution on the spot. An enemy of the people, they even used the term politically incorrect. The first act of the October Revolution was to order General Dukhonin, commander-in-chief of the Russian army, to sue for peace at any price. When he refused, he was lynched. They hung him, and a new commander was appointed. Leon Trotsky was now appointed commissioner or commissar for foreign affairs, and his first order of business was to negotiate the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, a town behind German lines in occupied Poland, which today is Belarus. Now, the Germans demanded recognition of the independence of Finland, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and the Ukraine, and also Georgia, and as all of these were really behind German lines and out of Russian control anywhere, they weren't actually asking them for anything. They weren't asking for money. They weren't asking for the navy. They weren't asking for the army. They weren't asking for gold. They just wanted recognition of the nations that always were independent, Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Ukraine, and Georgia, to be recognized to be free and independent countries. That was the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. Interesting that since 1990 and the fall of the Soviet Union, that's basically how the maps phased out anyway. What a pity the Versailles Treaty reversed all this. All those people, as they said to me, people in Ukraine, we were betrayed twice by you Westerners. Horrible thing to hear. Well, Lenin declared to the Petrograd Soviet to carry on a revolutionary war and army as needed. We do not have an army. It is a question of signing the terms of peace now or signing a death sentence for the Soviet government 3 weeks later. And so here's the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk in German, in Russian, and in all these other languages as well. After accepting the peace terms, Trotsky then resigned from foreign affairs. Now, interesting, here's the people involved in the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. Notice the Russians, the Germans, the Austrians, the Hungarians, they all sat around the same table. Unlike Versailles, where the Germans, Austrians, and Hungarians weren't allowed to be part of the discussions, they were just told what they had to accept at the end. So a very different treaty, and this was not a vindictive treaty. It didn't require anything. They weren't taking anything from Russia, except that which wasn't Russia's anyway, and which they had no control over at the time as it was. So it was, in fact, it should have been a very successful treaty, except that Versailles reversed it. And then Leon Trotsky became commissar for war, and his first priority was to defend the revolution. That's always their priority, defend the revolution against counter-revolutionaries. There's always counter-revolutionaries. Counter-revolutionaries are people like us, Bible smugglers, evangelists, people who say, this law doesn't make sense, or we were better off under the Tsar. You know, that's a counter-revolutionary. 50,000 former officers of the Tsarist army were taken into the Red Army. They needed some professionals. These were people whose only occupation was war, and they were good at it. And so they wanted a job. The Reds needed officers. And then they came up with the idea of having political commissars for every unit who could keep these ex-Tsarist officers in line. So the commissar effectively was had more power, effectively, than even a commanding officer when it came to political things. Over the next 3 years, Trotsky's Red Army grew to 5 million men controlled from his personal armored train. So isn't this interesting? What did they promise the people? Peace. But they got peace from an external enemy, but now they are going into a civil war, fighting against everyone who doesn't agree with the revolution. If you've seen Dr. Zhivago, you will notice that there's this character that plays a key role who's running the armored train. In fact, that's definitely based on Trotsky. Except that Trotsky was overseas in America at the time of the revolution, wasn't inside Russia. But nevertheless, aside from that. But it's plainly based on him because they're all dressed in leathers and so on. And this armored train is how Trotsky ran the war. And also at the end of Dr. Zhivago, you can see how Trotsky's no longer in favor with the Soviet government. He's got to flee into exile. And in fact, that's exactly true of the hero of the revolution, Trotsky, as well. So this mobile headquarters had a radio, map room, printing press, secretarial staff, Rolls Royce, vast quantities of ammunition and medicine. You see, Trotsky never lacked money. He continued to get millions from Chase Bank. The American capitalists were so keen to bankroll the Bolshevik Revolution. And so they lacked nothing. They had everything. They had the best of everything. They had the most advanced. And all of Trotsky's staff were issued in leather uniforms, which is not cheap. And all of the NKVD and Cheka, which became the KGB, they all had leather uniforms and so on. He had commanders and commissars executed. Whole units were subject to decimation, where every 10th man was just executed. They'd count the way down, every 10th man executed because of some failure of this unit. And so it was a reign of terror, not only on the outside, but even on their own men. This is a Trotsky armored train. Notice a lot of machine guns, a lot of high-tech weaponry, which was supplied by the Allies. On the 17th of July 1918, on the direct orders of Yakov Svedlov, who's on the left, Felix Dzerzhinsky, the head of the Cheka in the middle, and with the expressed agreement of Vladimir Lenin, whose picture is not shown here because Vladimir Lenin had himself written out of all the orders. But there is no doubt after decades of investigation that Lenin gave the order and that he wanted there to be a clear distinction so that Svedlov and Dzerzhinsky would take the blame and he would have a step out of, even though there's no way they would have done it without Lenin's permission. And the evidence now exists, 4 phone calls on the night before the murder to Lenin directly, either from Sverdlov or Dzerzhinsky or from the actual executioner in Yekaterinburg. In Yekaterinburg, the Soviets brutally murdered Tsar Nicholas, his wife, the Tsarina Alexandra, their four daughters, Olga, Tatiana, Maria, and Anastasia, and son Alexis, and their attendants, including their doctor, the nurse, the sailor who was looking after Alexis. All of them were murdered systematically. This is the House of Special Purpose, as they called it, although they wouldn't have seen it like this because there was a massive 4-meter-high palisade around the whole property so that no one from the outside could see what's going on, and no one on the inside could see what was going on outside either. The murder room was, you understand, as a basement, but wasn't totally underground. It was half underground. And they had 300 guards in and around this place on this property at the time of the execution. They had 4 machine guns fixed at different points around this house, aimed in every direction, so that if anyone tried to rescue them or if any of them tried to escape, they were not allowed to see out the windows. Their windows were first covered with newspaper, and then they were painted over with white, and their windows were sealed. Nobody could look out the window. At one point, Anastasia was shot at for trying to look out of a window. The brutality and the mindlessness of the communists in dealing with the royal family, they took away everything of theirs, their cameras, their books. They wouldn't let them have access to newspapers, no news, no one was allowed to talk to them, nobody was allowed to. Their own servants were forbidden to address them by their proper terms and were only to use their bare surnames. And there was so much harassment. They took away their gramophone, phonograph, and used it in the commandant's office just to play revolutionary songs, which is right next to the Tsar's bedroom, that they'd have to listen to these songs. They were forbidden to speak in any other language than Russian, because they could speak in German, French, any language around, but the commissars controlling them, of course, didn't understand those languages, and so they forbade them to speak in any language they couldn't supervise and overhear. They took away their luggage. They didn't allow them to have access to their own personal things. They took the gold bracelets off the girls' wrists. They stole everything they had. The vindictiveness with how they treated them, the pettiness of it, just so sick. And what's so outrageous to me is you turn to Wikipedia, and what does Wikipedia say? They've got the title of it, The Execution of the Romanov Family. The execution? How can you call a murder, a mass murder of a whole family, an execution? An execution suggests there's been a trial. There was no trial. It suggests there's been due process of law. There was no due process of law. There weren't even any charges. And even if there was, for the Tsar, how could his wife and his daughters and his son or his doctor or the maid or anyone else be guilty? How could the whole lot be guilty? There was no lawyer. There was no due process. There was no defense allowed. How can you call it an execution? I mean, Wikipedia is disgusting. How they can character assassinate such a magnificent Christian family and call it an execution. And the way that even good films have depicted the royal family in a way that's not fair to them. The lies of the government. If this was really an execution, why was it the Russian government denied it had happened? For 8 years, they denied the whole thing had happened totally. There was lies, lies, lies. For 8 years, they denied that any of the royal family were dead. They admitted after a while to having shot the Tsar after a trial, which never happened. But they said his wife and children had been sent to a safe location. For 8 years, they denied. And then they came out with, they've been killed by left-wing revolutionaries. And it was lies, lies, lies. And all the way through till the 1980s, they denied, denied, denied. And only in 1989 was there this first admission that actually this had been done. But then they were trying to blame just the local Soviet. Then all the phone records came out and all the telegrams that went backwards and forwards. And plainly they were being instructed by Dzerzhinsky and Sverdlov, who were directly in touch with Lenin the whole time. And it's come out now without a doubt. Lenin gave the order. This was from the top. It was systematic murder, and yet the Marxists just lied on every level for all this time. And so it took, notice the date of this. This is September. In September, you started to have in the Daily Mirror a report about the royal family's been murdered. And this is because some witnesses in the town had heard and so on and had escaped. And some words that come through the Whites out of Crimea. And so this is still without proper full details. And so in 1918, 17th of July 1918, on the 100th anniversary, tens of thousands of Russians walked to the site of the murder in Yekaterinburg, led by the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church. And they have built a magnificent church on the site, because under Gorbachev, they destroyed the House of Special Purpose because too many pilgrims are coming there. Well, a church has since built a Church of the Blood, as they call it, and the Church of All Saints over the site. There have been many magnificent books produced since, and I hope some decent films will be produced in time, and monuments for the martyrs. This is the church now built, they call it Church of Blood, but it's officially the Church of All Saints, built over the site where the House of Special Purpose was built. And to remember the first victims, and this just shows you what Marxism is, because these were innocent victims, but they were just the first of 66 million innocent victims to die at the hands of the communists in the Soviet Union. 6 weeks later, Vladimir Lenin was shot in the chest, arm, and neck by socialist revolutionary Fania Kaplan, depicted here. And there's Lenin falling back under the impact. Well, before execution, and she's executed just a few days later, Fania explained, "I've long had the intention of killing Lenin. In my eyes, he has betrayed the revolution. I was for the Constituent Assembly, and I still am." Well, he closed the Constituent Assembly, which was elected by the people. And he didn't like the result. And so he's a dictator, and a lot of people had suffered. So here's a brave young woman who chose to kill this horrible creep, but sadly she failed. But while he survived the attempted assassination, his health was undermined. Interestingly, by the way, most of those who took part in the murder gang in the cellar, those Cheka mass murderers, most of them were killed during the purges. Some were killed very soon after that by their own people, as in orders from Stalin and so on. So they all got it in the neck themselves in time, one after the other. So it's incredible. What you sow is what you reap. But the Bolshevik response to the attempted assassination of Lenin was to promulgate an official state of red terror directed by the leather-jacketed secret policeman of the Special Commission, or the Cheka, the forerunner of the NKVD, which later became the KGB. They might change the name, but it doesn't change its essence. Hundreds of thousands were executed under Vladimir Lenin, and millions more imprisoned in the Gulag, a network of 1,200 concentration camps which spread across the Arctic wastes of Siberia. Now, the Czech Legion rebelled and fought eastwards across the Trans-Siberian Railway in an attempt to get home. Now, you can see the Bolsheviks controlled this area. Those areas had seceded and were independent. And you can see that, in fact, most of Russia was not under the hands of the Bolsheviks. And there was a lot of resistance, which they called the Whites, but they weren't all. There was another group called the Greens, who were but anarchistic. Admiral Kolchak led the Siberian government of the White Armies against the Reds. And here's Admiral Kolchak in front here. And the Socialist Revolution Party set up an administration of the Volga River, claiming to rule in the name of the Constituent Assembly. There were 19 different governments appearing during the course of the Civil War, operating in different parts. And so this idea that Vladimir Lenin overthrew the Tsar and all lived happily ever after, it's just so divorced from reality. It's got no relationship to what actually happened. And the Bolshevik Revolution could not have succeeded without massive Western aid, colossal Western aid. You can see how they were so contracted at one point. Most of Russia was under control of Whites, and a diminishing area was under the Reds. Azerbaijan, a Turkish and Muslim land down here on the banks of the Caspian Sea, they declared the independence. Armenia, its Christian neighbor, which is on the mountains of Ararat, where Noah finally landed with his ark, they declared independence. 26th of May, 1918, Georgia declared its independence. It's not the one you think about in America. It's the Georgia on the Black Sea, which, by the way, where Joseph Stalin came from. British, American, French troops were landed at Murmansk, and Archangel, in the far north in Vladivostok to prevent Japan from seizing it, and particularly the Americans went to Vladivostok not to stop the Reds taking it. In fact, they were just there to stop Japan seizing it. And when the Red Army finally managed to reach Vladivostok, the American forces saluted, handed over, and withdrew into their ships. And the Russians actually thanked them for preserving Vladivostok from the Japanese. This kind of short-sightedness in the Western governments boggles the brain. And so you can see the British and Americans were top, and most of the aid they were sent in that was meant to get to the Whites actually was given treacherously to the Reds. And so you can see you've got the Czech Legion on the Trans-Siberian Highway, you've got the Americans and Japanese in this area of Vladivostok on the Pacific. The British Navy came in to the Caspian Sea and to the Black Sea. The French also moved in. You can see quite a bit of intervention, but none of it was effectual. And interesting enough that Professor Anthony Sutton, who was the research professor of Stanford University for the Hoover Institute on Revolution, War, and Peace, he says straight out, he said, they never intervened in order to stop the Bolsheviks. They intervened to aid the Bolsheviks. Now, the soldiers on the ground wouldn't have done that. They were lied to. But the government's intention plainly was to aid the Soviets because that's where all the aid went to. And he's got such strong evidence in the best enemy money can buy. And the question, of course, comes about why. Well, Winston Churchill wrote of the Bolsheviks as baboons and a new bubonic plague, a new Black Death. Millions of pounds of Western aircraft, tanks, machine guns, and uniforms, which was meant to equip the White Army resisting Reds, ended up in the Red Army sometimes directly. Thousands of Allied troops were abandoned and betrayed in the hands of the Bolsheviks. In fact, Captain Red McDaniel, who was 6 years U.S. Naval captain, 6 years in Vietnam, tortured by the communists, he wrote the book Scars and Stripes. I've met him. And he ran the Missing in Action Foundation. And he said the Missing in Action didn't start with Vietnam. Said America abandoned thousands of their troops, of 4,000, in North Korea in the hands of the Chinese. They abandoned tens of thousands of their prisoners of war who were in Eastern Germany, in East Germany, taken over by the Soviets after the Second World War. None ever returned. The Soviets first kept them as hostages, saying, if you don't do this, that, and the other, we won't release them. And after a while, they turned it into, if you don't do this, that, and the other that we want, we'll let the world know that you've abandoned your men here for these last years. And so they worked it both ways and said, again, there was First World War intervention into the Civil War in Russia. Thousands of British and American troops were abandoned in the hands of the Reds, never returned, and their governments just acted like they didn't know about. So there's an actual, continuous, steady pattern of treachery from Woodrow Wilson all the way through Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Truman, and through Lyndon Johnson. Treachery, betraying their own people. And I heard this directly from Captain Red McDaniel. So I heard this from people in America, like the colonel who was involved in the Nicaragua-Contra scandal, Oliver North, straight from Oliver North as well. And I remember thinking, I praise God I'm a South African. Our government would never betray our men. And I was convinced of that at that time. But when I was locked up in Mozambique in 1989 in Mashava Security Prison, one day passing outside my cell, which you couldn't see out the window unless you lifted yourself up, which was way above head height, looking through the bars, I saw a white man there, which is quite rare, and I asked his name, turned out to be a South African recce. And how long has he been here? He'd been there for 5 years. Now, I'm well informed, and I ministered in over 1,000 South African military bases and meetings all over the time throughout the 80s, so I'd never heard of us having any soldiers left behind in Mozambique. Oh, there's another two there. There are three of them. Well, I memorized their names and their force numbers and details, and when I got back to South Africa, I immediately went to military intelligence and said, do you know about these guys? Yes. why haven't you done anything? He said, well, we don't want to endanger their lives. I said, endanger their lives? They're in the hands of SNASP security in Mashava security prison. It doesn't get any more dangerous than that. Couldn't they still South African citizens? Surely someone could have visited them. They haven't been given a package, a parcel, soap, salt, toothpaste, toothbrush, writing materials, book, Bible, nothing. Not a single visit from the South African embassy. Oh, it's very difficult. And I said, I'll tell you how difficult it is. I went to the Sunday Times, got this published. They were out within the week. Now, how is it the Southern government could do nothing for 5 years, but a nobody missionary could get them out in a week? That's how much our governments care about us. I never would have believed it possible. I thought Western governments had a sense of honor. I thought our government had a sense of honor, even after I learned that the American government had none, but the National Party, a bunch of traitors, backstabbers. But we know that. This is how contracted the Bolshevik-controlled areas were at one time. They were so close to being snuffed out. Just a little bit of effort. Just a minuscule 1% of 1% of the effort that they put onto the Western Front could have saved Russia at this critical time. The Bolsheviks were nothing. And yet they were allowed to take that whole great country and murder millions. Millions were massacred during the Red Terror. Torture and murder was simple, and it was a daily, daily reality. So Professor Anthony Sutton wrote Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, the remarkable true story of American capitalists who financed the Russian communists. Rothschild of Chase Bank, Henry Ford, and Armand Hammer. Three particular names that come to my mind, but there's a lot more details in the book, and I think I must do a presentation just on this one time. He followed this up with the best enemy money can buy, showing how America built their tanks, built their trucks, built the biggest tank and truck manufacturing plants in the world, the gas trucks, which we were facing in Angola, the T-55 tanks and the T-34 tanks we were facing, the missiles from the stolen organs we faced, they're all built by Ford Motor Company in a 5-kilometer-squared factory, the biggest vehicle factory in the world in the Urals, built by American technology, built with technology transfer. He said it wasn't just to refinance them. We transferred the technology to them. Even the missiles they had, everything. It all came from the West. Now, of course, the big question is why? 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 Professor Anthony Sutton says, and I'm just quoting from him, he said, looking at Russia at the beginning of the 20th century, it was clear they were going to eclipse Britain, France, the United States, and everything. They already were, agriculturally, industrially. They already had more ships than the British Merchant Marine. British Merchant Marine had 10 million tons. Russia had 11 million tons. They were beating the West in everything, and they had this inexhaustible amount of raw material and a vast population. And he said, American capitalists looked and said, they will be our biggest competitor, and they're going to outstrip us economically this century. And they looked at the Bolsheviks and saw there's a great way of derailing, because they knew the socialists couldn't succeed. They'd bankrupt the country. And so to destroy the economic competitor, these people, like the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, and the Armand Hammers, decided to fund the Bolsheviks. Just cost a few hundred million. And then they decided to keep them going. And at first it was to destroy Russia as an economic competitor. But there was also the vendetta of the Rothschild family for the Romanov family for having resisted ever allowing a Rothschild bank in Russia. But it was after that, it was more than that. They found it extremely financially beneficial to have this arms race where continually more money had to be borrowed and more taxes had to be raised and high interest rates could be charged and people could be kept in a panic over all the missiles. And so when the Russians were too far behind, they transferred the technology. Not just the technology, everything from cruise missiles, you name it, went over to Russia by treachery, deceit. And this isn't my theory, this is what Professor Sutton documents. The best enemy money can buy. And just an extraordinary thing, as he said, the weapons that were killing American soldiers in Vietnam were being transported from Russia in Russian trucks, all of them built with American technology and financed by America to kill American soldiers in Vietnam. And this sort of thing, that's subject for another night. But by 1921, the Bolsheviks had ruined the economy. According to history books, Russia was backward under the Tsars, and the communists made a tremendously industrial revolution thing. In fact, not so. According to Professor Sutton's stats, Russia went to 8% of its industrial capacity in the first 10 years under Bolsheviks, from what it had been under the Tsar, down to 8%, not 8% growth, down to 8% of its previous. So sort of like what Mugabe succeeded in doing in Zimbabwe, that kind of economic miracle. And agriculturally devastated. Instead of being the granary and breadbasket of the world, it became the place of the worst famine. Destruction. You see over here, IWM. It's the Imperial War Museum, pictured from London. Inflation was astronomical. Hundreds of thousands of workers fled the city in hope of finding food in the countryside. The entire economy collapsed as iron detachments of Bolsheviks under the Cheka sign forcibly confiscated or requisitioned all the food they could get their hands on the villages to feed workers in the city. Thousands of orphan children roamed the streets, prey to disease and cruelty, their parents dead. Terrible famine struck the whole Volga region. Millions starved to death. If you've seen the film, the drama on Bitter Harvest, you've got some idea. This is just one Chicago newspaper. 6 million perished from Soviet famine. That's just some of them. That's just in 1936. This isn't all of them. More than 11 million perished in the famine. Unorganized, armed only with pitchforks, scythes, and flails, hungry peasants rose up against the new oppressors in an attempt to survive, mowed down by machine guns and tanks provided by the Americans. 50,000 Red Troops were mobilized to execute whole villages, exile millions to the waste areas of Siberia, and violently put down strikes. But strikes were forbidden under the Bolsheviks. The Tsar allowed strikes, but the Bolsheviks didn't. The workers' paradise doesn't allow strikes. All opposition was outlawed. Criticism of the government's policies was outlawed. Only one party allowed, the Communist Party. The independent countries of Georgia, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Armenia were forcibly enslaved back into the Soviet Union, as was Ukraine. Vladimir Lenin famously declared, "It does not matter if 3/4 of the population of Russia perish, as long as the remaining quarter are communist." The Black Book of Communism, written by communists, documents, according to their own archives, the total death toll is at least 100 million people killed by communist governments between 1917 and 1991. This does not include China, because Chinese archives are not open yet. As the Black Book documents, communist states did not merely commit criminal acts. They were criminal enterprises in the very instance. On principle, so to speak, they ruled lawlessly by violence and without regard to human life. And without regard to animal life either. The destruction of the livestock of Ukraine, Russia, just boggles the brain. This, by the way, is not written by anti-communists like Alexander Solzhenitsyn. This is what communists themselves have written, including the editor of Communism magazine. Joseph Stalin said, "The death of one person is a tragedy, but the death of millions, it's just a statistic." They promised them freedom while they themselves are slaves of depravity. When Lenin died of his third stroke on the 21st of January, 1924, my birthday is 21st of January, and I always think, well, that's one reason to be very grateful for 21st January, anniversary of Vladimir Lenin's death, one of the most evil people in history, and the birthday of Stonewall Jackson, factory sirens blared out across the country. St. Petersburg was renamed Leningrad. Praise God, it's been renamed St. Petersburg again. This decision was made then to embalm the corpse. Now, when you think that people are dying of starvation all over Russia this time, this kind of opulence is just nauseating. It's perverse. Inspired by the recent discovery of the tomb of Tutankhamun by the real inhabitant of Downton Abbey, by the way, that lord, had just discovered Tutankhamun's tomb. There was a revival of interest in Egypt. And so the atheistic religious cult was formed by building a pyramid-like temple inspired by the Egyptian House of the Dead, where faithful party members would pay their respects to the god of the Soviet Union, Vladimir Lenin. And here's the mausoleum of Lenin. There's Lenin's bones. And so on May Day, the Russian Politburo line up above the bones of Lenin to watch the review of Satan's own armies marching past on Red Square. And the faithful, millions every year, lined up in the snow to come and pay respects to their God who set out in some kind of real red and this lifelike type of image. So their God's obviously dead, but this is the kind of atheistic religious cult they've got. And here's a cartoon at the time showing how the people are sacrificing Christian ministers on the altar of Karl Marx, which you could say Vladimir Lenin and Mao Zedong as well. By the way, this is a statue to Yakov that doesn't exist anymore, but it was in Yekaterinburg to commemorate the man who murdered the Tsar. He was in charge of the Cheka murder squad. Alexander Solzhenitsyn declared, "The world has never before known a godlessness as organized, militarized, and tenaciously malevolent, malicious, as that preached by Marxism. Within the philosophical system of Marx and Lenin, and at the heart of their psychology, hatred of God is the principal driving force, more fundamental in all their political and economic pretensions. Militant atheism is not merely incidental or marginal to communist policy. It's not a side effect. It's the central pivot. To achieve its diabolical end," that's devilish ends, "communism needs to control a population devoid of religious or national feeling. And this entails the destruction of faith and nationhood. Communists proclaim both these objectives openly, and just as openly they put them into practice." That from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Richard Wurmbrand has documented this in his Marx and Satan book. Here he quotes from Karl Marx, "The hellish vapors rise and fill the brain, till I go mad and my heart is utterly changed. See the sword the Prince of Darkness sold it to me. For me beats the time and gives the signs. Ever more boldly I play the dance of death." Marx would say, everything in existence is worth being destroyed. Everything in existence is worth being destroyed. "If there's something which devours, I'll leap within it. Though I bring the world to ruins, the world which bulks between me and the abyss, I will smash to pieces with my enduring curses." If you want to know why is there so much destruction amongst revolutionaries, destruction is at the heart of it. It's a demonic force. Without a doubt, Karl Marx was a Satanist. And this communism is the religion of Satan. "Without violence, nothing is ever accomplished in history." Quote unquote from Karl Marx. Under Vladimir Lenin, one of the slogans of the Soviet Union was, "We fight against God to snatch believers from him." I heard from Christians in Angola who had been in concentration camps of the Soviets and Cubans who said, as they were being tortured, they said, "Why don't you just kill us and get over with?" And one of the guards said to them, "Oh no, no, we don't want to kill you. We don't want to kill you and send you to heaven with God. No, we want you to curse Christ and come to hell with us for all eternity." Now, I've heard in slightly different words from people in Mozambique and Eastern Europe. A prominent slogan of the Communist Party and the Soviet Union was, "Let us drive out the capitalists from the earth and God from heaven." And Alexander Solzhenitsyn documented this in his Gulag Archipelago book, and one day the life of Ivan Denisovich. Now, Alexander Solzhenitsyn was 8 years in a concentration camp. He was a Red Army, World War II veteran in artillery. And because he made a slightly critical comment to the chairman, Stalin, he ended up for 8 years in a concentration camp in Siberia. He said, "You must understand the leading Bolsheviks who took over Russia were not Russians. They hated Russians. They hated Christians. Their ethnic hatred led them to torture and slaughter millions of Russians without a shred of human remorse. It cannot be overstated. Bolshevism committed the greatest human slaughter of all time. The fact that most of the world is ignorant and uncaring about this enormous crime is proof that the global media is in the hands of the perpetrators. Our mass media is in the hands of the people who love the Marxists. Power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely." How many films have you seen made of the Bolshevik mass murders and the Holodomor in Ukraine and all the rest? Now, these are Lenin's cabinet. And in fact, it's quite intriguing because communism's cannibalistic. They kill their own. Virtually everyone on here was murdered by another Bolshevik. It's just incredible. Right down to heads of the Cheka, even. And, well, Lenin died normally. Kamenev was shot. Zinoviev was shot. Trotsky was murdered, literally axed, killed by Stalin's order. Bukharin, who was once head of NKVD, shot. Rakov shot. Tomsky, suicide. Maybe. Stalin survived. Trotsky fled all the way to Mexico City, had bodyguards and so on. He was executed. By the way, just the week before he died, he said, even though I've been exiled from the revolution I fought for, in fact, no one did more for the revolution than Trotsky, he said, I have to believe the party is always right. In fact, that's the title of one of Solzhenitsyn's books, We Never Make Mistakes, quote unquote, from the Soviet Communist Party. We never make mistakes. You know why? Because the party's God. They're infallible. And all of these characters, they all got killed, one after the other. Stalin killed the entire Politburo of, and here you can see it in red. The ones in red were murdered. The ones in purple died in the Civil War or committed suicide. And the ones in green died of things like heart attacks and cerebral hemorrhage. But these, the only one who really seemed to have survived was Stalin, because he had everyone else wiped out one way or the other. And only those escaped him who died of natural cause or committed suicide first. And so here's the general staff of 1917. By the way, this was put together by Trotsky, I believe, and showing, because he's in exile, and that Stalin's the only one left of Lenin's general staff in 1917, because all the others died or were murdered. Most were murdered. David Francis, United States ambassador in Russia, warned in a January 1918 dispatch to Washington, the Bolshevik leaders here, most of whom are Jews, and 90% of whom are returned exiles like Trotsky, care little for Russia or any other country, but are internationalists, and they're trying to start a worldwide social revolution. Winston Churchill in 1920 wrote this article in the newspaper, Illustrated Sunday Herald, Zionism versus Bolshevism, a struggle for the soul of the Jewish people, pointing out that the mass of more than 90% of the Bolshevik upper echelon command are Jewish, but the atheistic Jewish. They hate God, they hate Christianity. And he's saying, the trouble is that right now you've got a choice, and there's a lot of the Jewish people who are being sucked into Bolshevism, and he's saying this is a battle for the soul. He says, you can't say every Jewish person is a communist, but you can say the entire upper leadership of the Communist Party in Russia right now are Jewish, and that this is a battle for the soul, and it's got to be addressed. And there was a lot of Jewish support for the Bolshevik Revolution initially. According to Joseph Stalin, ideas are more powerful than guns. We would not let our enemies have guns. Why should we let them have ideas? Gun control, thought control too. God is on your side? Is he a conservative? The devil is on my side. He's a good communist. That's a nice quote from Joseph Stalin. How do you like this for unrealistic? Now, when you've got to have an artist depict this, it's because there's no photograph of this, because they can't. Joseph Stalin so loved, and behind him is Stalin. By the way, there's suspicion that Stalin had him bumped off because he would need to take over. Marx, Engels, Lenin, Stalin. Now it goes further. Marx, Engels, Lenin, Stalin, Mao Zedong. And I'm sure that others would like to put Mugabe's face or Castro's or Malema, wannabes. One of the books in our library up there is the first guidebook to the Soviet Union's prisons and concentration camps. They documented 1,200 concentration camps in the Soviet Union, where 55 million people were swallowed up. This is a children's camp, children's camp. This is just women's and children's camps in the Soviet Union, most of which is in the very, very harsh Siberian climates. And they said the women are only used for light work. Here you can see a woman carrying a pole doing just light work. And these women are digging canals. In fact, Sabrina Wilmbrandt spent 5 years as a slave in Sabrina Wilmbrandt, Richard Wilmbrandt's wife, digging a canal. And obviously with spades, you're not talking about real equipment. Here you can see more women doing light work, building whole canals. And here's other women being used to pull barges along these canals, like cattle. And these are the death camps documented in the guidebook. And in these camps, Arctic hellholes, 55 million people had their lives ruined and wrecked in the Gulag, as described in the Gulag Archipelago and One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. Look at the angle, the steepness of this, and think of pushing up a wheelbarrow that full of earth up that kind of angle. And the squalor and the degradation that they reduced human beings to their defiant belief. While they promise liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. But I must end with a positive note. Symbolic of the failure of atheism and the triumph of faith in Russia is Christ the Savior Cathedral, which was destroyed in 1931 by the order of communist dictator Joseph Stalin. The Cathedral of Christ the Savior, northern bank of the Moscow River, was built during the 19th century. It took 40 years to construct. In 1931, demolished by order of communist dictator Joseph Stalin. The demolition was supposed to make way for a colossal Palace of the Soviets, which was never built. The original church was the scene of the 1882 world premiere of the world-famous 1812 overture by Tchaikovsky. Christ the Savior Cathedral had been consecrated and constructed in the initiative of Tsar Alexander I upon the Russian victory over Napoleon Bonaparte when he defeated for Moscow 25 December 1812. This was Napoleon's high watermark of the French revolutionary forces, and their winter retreat has been well depicted in War and Peace. The Tsar declared, to signify gratitude to divine providence for saving Russia from the doom which overshadowed her, the cathedral was to be constructed as a memorial and as a testimony to God's saving grace in answer to prayer. And it was anticipated this would stand for 1,000 years. Consecrated 26th of May, 1883, the day before Alexander III was crowned. It was this iconic church that Joseph Stalin determined to demolish. And so on the 5th of December 1931, the Cathedral of Christ Savior was dynamited and reduced to rubble, being filmed, documented. This symbolized the triumph of atheism over faith. And so this went worldwide. We have destroyed Christ the Savior Cathedral, the largest church in Russia, the third largest church in the world at that time. It took them a year to remove the rubble from the site. Now, Joseph Stalin was determined to erect a Palace of Soviets in a modernistic buttress style, like the Tower of Babel, with a gigantic statue of Vladimir Lenin perched on the top of the dome with his arm defiantly raised into the air, like a raised fist in the face of God. This is how they anticipated this monstrosity to look. But lack of funds and problems with flooding from a nearby river and outbreak of war, Operation Barbarossa in 1941, prevented this project from succeeding. Communism marched on. They took more and more territory, but the Iron Curtain came down. The Iron Curtain, which had divided Europe, collapsed. The Soviet influence, you know, when they speak about this being Eastern Europe, actually that's Central Europe. Eastern Europe's Russia. And communism was the greatest fact in the first half of my life. But 31 years ago, the Berlin Wall came down. The Leipzig prayer meeting triumphed. 7-year Jericho prayer march initiative was successful. And we saw the Iron Curtain collapse, the Berlin Wall come down, Soviet satellites from one side to the other topple, and the idols of Vladimir Lenin came down. And there was such a triumph of joy and celebration throughout the world. And even in his hometown of Gori, Joseph Stalin's statue finally came down. February 1990, the Russian Orthodox Church received permission from Boris Yeltsin's government to rebuild the Cathedral of Christ the Savior on its original site, to the original specs. Donations were collected from 1 million Russians who, remember, were pretty poor, and the cathedral was consecrated 19th August, year 2000. And here you can see, well, the Kremlin's on the right, across the river, there's the Church of Christ the Savior Cathedral. Magnificent church, very impressive, symbolic not just of the city but of the nation's faith. And they didn't cut corners. They built this to the original specs. In the year 2000, the cathedral was the venue for the canonization of the Romanovs when the murdered Tsar Nicholas II and his family were recognized as saints, and a chapel in the cathedral was dedicated to their memory with magnificent artwork. And this stands as a testament to the fact that the gates of hell shall not prevail against the church. It's not the way we would do it. These are Orthodox people, but the Orthodox express their faith in a lot of this kind of iconic art. But there is no doubt that atheism has failed and faith has triumphed in Russia. And here's St. Basil's Cathedral. And it's quite funny to think that every Easter, while people are lined up to go to Lenin's tomb and to look at their God who's dead, that the sound resounds out of Christ Savior Cathedral, he is not here. He is risen from the dead. And we serve a risen Savior. Well, the Orthodox Church in Russia is now the largest and most important non-governmental organization in the country. Church symbols, Christian rituals, moral values, Bible teachings are playing a leading role in shaping national society in Russia today. Up to 80% of Russians claim to be Orthodox members and have been baptized. And the Russian Orthodox Church alone is building, I hear my stats are out of date now, it's 500 churches are being built in Moscow right now, are in the process of being built. Well, 900 meters northeast of Red Square, you get Lubyanka Square, where a huge statue of Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the Cheka, which later became the NKVD, which later became the KGB, was erected in 1958. Now, when somebody heard he's gone to the Lubyanka, or you've been summoned to the Lubyanka, the people's blood ran cold. Lubyanka is a place of terror. It's the KGB headquarters. Tens of thousands of Christians were interrogated, tortured, and murdered in the Lubyanka. And so Dzerzhinsky's statue and his symbols, which is part of May Days, was a symbol of hate. And so people brought down Dzerzhinsky's statues all over Russia. And in 1991, it was removed from the front of the Lubyanka. And people vented their fury on it. And today you can go and wipe your boots on Dzerzhinsky's statue in the park, where they've been dumped with a whole lot of other unnecessary idols. And so you go to Lubyanka now and no statue. Now, immediately this should get people thinking, because Christians have brought a simple stone into that same square where once the statue stood. Now, the statue was in the middle of the traffic circle. This is to the side in a park which was adjacent. But that stone comes from Solovetsky Monastery, from Solovetsky Island, which was turned into the first prototype concentration camp of the Soviet Union. So here's the circle. There's the park. And there they've got the stone. And the symbolism of the victory of Christ over communism is very striking. You know the vision of Daniel, chapter 2. The head of gold, the chest of silver, the stomach of bronze, the legs of iron, the feet of iron and clay, and the stone comes and strikes the statue and it crumbles to dust. And the wind blows the dust away, and the stone grows to be a mountain that fills the whole earth. And the kingdom of God will not be left to other people. It will break in pieces and consume all those kingdoms, but it itself will stand forever. The Lord Jesus declared in Luke 20, the stone which the builders rejected as worthless has become the chief cornerstone. Whoever falls on that stone will be broken, but on whomever it falls, it'll grind them to powder. Repeated also in Luke 20 and Matthew 21, verse 44. On whomever that stone, whoever falls on that stone will be broken, but on whomever it falls, it'll grind them to powder. And all over, we see the symbolism of the statue and the stone, like in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. After the fall of Mengistu's Red Terror, people took down a statue of Lenin there. And so this is symbolic of the victory of faith over atheism. And with the Russian governor hosting international conferences on family and Christian values, pro-life, inviting people from 100 countries of the world within the Kremlin, all paid for by the state. What country in the world would invite people from all over the world to deal with pro-life, pro-family, against the homosexual agenda? It's just extraordinary. And I've had Patrick Johnson of Operation World in this boardroom, and he asked me this question. Where will you find the most Bible-believing, born-again Christians in Europe today? Russia. Not percentage, but number. There's more Bible-believing, born-again Christians in Russia than anywhere else in Europe, in any other single country. Second largest, Ukraine. Third largest, Romania. We must be so taken by the fact that the strongest churches in Europe are behind what used to be the Iron Curtain. In other words, decades of violent communist persecution and atheist propaganda were less effective in destroying the church, was ineffective actually, than seductive Western materialism and humanism in the schools and Hollywood entertainment has been destroying the church in the West. Persecution does not destroy the church, but secular humanist education and Hollywood entertainment, that subverts the church. What's more dangerous, Western humanism or Eastern communism? Well, it's interesting that despite all they've suffered, and one doesn't want to minimize it, but the fact is the church in Russia is strong, and Ukraine, and not only in Ukraine, but in Romania. Now, this is interesting. This isn't the way we do it. I don't go for icons of Christ, but bear in mind these are Orthodox Christians. This is the cabinet room of Vladimir Putin. On the wall behind is not a hammer and sickle anymore. There used to be. It's not a picture of Vladimir Lenin. It's an icon of Christ. That says something. It shouts something. This is not the way we would express our faith. But it is a faith, nonetheless. Now, you can Google Vladimir Putin's testimony, and you tell me what you think. But I've listened to it, and it sounds pretty impressive. My father was an atheist. My father was a Communist Party man. My mother was a secret Orthodox believer. She had me secretly baptized. She kept this cross, pulls it out, which gave me later when I was converted, and told me to always wear it and never take it off. Puts his cross back in. And he had a life-threatening experience which in the 90s, which led him to come back to his Orthodox roots. The Orthodox Church in Russia calls him a dedicated church member, faithful Orthodox member. Now, it's not the terminology we would use as evangelicals and Protestants and Pentecostals, but there's no doubt within the Orthodox framework, he is a sincere believer who has come out of an atheist to communist regime where he was in the KGB and where now he's embracing Christianity enthusiastically. Chaplains are appointed in the military. There's no more commissars. Look at the flag of the Russian Navy. It's the St. Andrew's Cross. They print Bibles for hotels. The Russian government does. The president attends service in the Cathedral of Christ the Savior. The failure of the atheist experiment in Russia is complete. Jesus said, I will build my church on this rock and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. So I think at this time we're facing very clearly in the West a choice between reformation or revolution. Who will rise up for me against the evildoers? Who will stand up for me against the workers of iniquity? Any questions or comments? Yes.
I'll find out historically the president who followed Stalin and the rest of those stole 1991, were they still murdering the people?
Yes. Yes, yes. Definitely, without doubt. We've got the books up here. We documented not only Black Book of Communism, but a whole lot of others too. Now, Stalin was the biggest mass murderer. But Khrushchev also murdered many. And so did Brezhnev. In fact, under Brezhnev, where we had detente, there were still 5 million people in the concentration camps. Yeah. A lot less than under Stalin, but 5 million people who were in concentration camps, of which 1 million were there for religious offense alone under Brezhnev, who was having detente. Gorbachev, who was running perestroika what else was called? Glasnost and perestroika. He only had 1 million people in the concentration camps. And of course, under him, they were invading Afghanistan and murdering people in Afghanistan, so on. So, in fact, under Gorbachev, they were burning and killing Christians and churches in Angola. They were using mustard gas and chemical warfare in Angola. So, no, I would say the whole bunch of them. Lenin, Stalin, Khrushchev, Brezhnev, Chernenko, Andropov, Gorbachev, they were all Marxist mass murderers. And the difference in degree would be all, but I'd say they're all in exactly the same category of the communists. Like, what's the difference between Mugabe and Mnangagwa? Ask a Zimbabwean. Some of them will say Mnangagwa's worse, which is hard to believe, but certainly is not better. I would say Mugabe is worse, but the people living in Zimbabwe say, no, it's worse under Mnangagwa. Well, maybe it's just because that's what they're living with right now, but it's not an improvement. Yeah. So whereas Boris Yeltsin was a dramatic difference and change, and under Vladimir Putin, the openness to the church has gone even further. So there's no doubt this is a new dawn in Russia. The amazing thing is the same press in America who so slavishly was pro-Russian in the days of communism are now anti-Russian, not because Putin used to be communist, but because he's against the homosexual agenda, because he's for families, because he's for pro-life, because they've got laws against blasphemy and so on. So really, I think the people hate Putin because he's anti-communist, not because he's got a communist background. Other comments?
We are the communists in this country.
Yes, we are.
How long is it going to be before we defeat them, or before they collapse on themselves?
Well,
what do you think is going to happen? They're busy destroying what they call white businesses, which means
yes.
All businesses.
Yes.
In other words, we waited for Zimbabwe to collapse. It hasn't collapsed. I think mainly because South Africa or the ANC have propped it up.
We keep propping it up, yes.
But do you think it's just going to implode because communism is so evil it tends to implode on itself?
It will implode, but remember, in Russia it took 7 years, although it would have collapsed a lot quicker if it hadn't been for outside aid that propped it up. And the only thing that brought down the Soviet Union in the end, ultimately, was because Ronald Reagan said no more bailouts. And he managed to persuade American allies to also stop. And so Margaret Thatcher, Helmut Kohl, all said no more aid. And East Germany had always been able to turn to West Germany and eke out more, this, that, and the other. And Britain was always sending bailouts. But because you had these strong people for a moment, for the decade of the 80s, Margaret Thatcher in Britain, Helmut Kohl in Germany, and Ronald Reagan in America, most importantly, who stopped bailing them out. And then Ronald Reagan increased economic warfare and an arms race that they could not win without giving them the technology they'd allowed before. That brought them down, but it wasn't only that that brought down Soviet Union. It was the internal resistance from the persecuted church and the Bible smugglers and the Christian radio broadcast and the resistance fighters. UNITA in Angola, RENAMO in Mozambique, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, the Contras in Nicaragua, and Solidarity in Poland, and so many other resistance. So, and then you've got to have behind the scenes, you've got people like Brother Andrew and others who launched the Jericho Prayer Initiative, the 7-year Jericho Prayer March and the Leipzig Prayer Meeting, which was birthed in East Germany, of resistance to communism. So many things brought down the unbeatable foe. And of course, you can't in one sense overemphasize one to the neglect of the other, because they're all important parts of the battle. To bring down this government, we know they will bankrupt themselves. But the trouble is they've been bailed out over and over and over from outside forces. And as citizens of this country, we try to make things work ourselves. We're not trying to make the system fail. We're trying to make it work. And they're trying to prevent us. So obviously there's got to be the prayer. There's got to be the teaching. There's got to be the resistance. There's got to be legal challenges. All of that's important. And referendums and Cape independence is one of the ingredients in this whole mix that I see. But understand this, the lockdown is Marxism. This is a gift from Satan to the communists. Because what is communism? Under Politburo, you need permission from the state for everything. The state decides who can work, when they can work, where they can work, how they can work. Show me your papers. Where's your permission? Travel documents, please. The moment you leave town, there's a checkpoint. Where are you going? Why are you going? Show me your papers. Who's with you? Why they're with you? Where are you going to stay? So all of this micromanaging by the state, that is communism. Total control means totalitarianism is communism. Total state control. So when they come in, and the fact that they've learned, we can do this through a virus. We're concerned about your health. And on that basis, they are going to destroy. Sorry?
Sanctity of life.
Say the people who kill the babies.
While they make
abortions. So just imagine.
2,600 deaths.
Yes. And they declare most of the occupations of most of the population of this country non-essential. How disgusting is that? I would say virtually the entire government's non-essential. Everything that helps the economy work is essential. This government is a cancer. They are a cell in the body that doesn't contribute to the health of the body. They are a cancer that rots the health of the body. And that's why I say the middle letters of cancer is ANC, and I always write about the government, small c, capital ANC, small er, you know, because that just reminds us what we're dealing with. They are a cancer. They are not contributing to the health of this society. In fact, we know we don't need the government because we have private security companies. We do private initiatives for everything because they're not doing what we're paying rates and taxes for. So why don't we just cut out the rates and taxes and go directly to the people who are doing the job, which is actually makes sense. When I was growing up, you didn't get paid for being a city councillor. You didn't get paid for being a member of parliament. It was an honorary position. You donated your time. Now it's a get-rich-quick scheme. But they're not happy with that. They've got to loot billions more in addition to the exorbitant salaries and perks they get. So the whole system's rigged. And it's obviously a criminal government. So just as I said with the Bolsheviks. Now, the Bolsheviks came out of a world war. And therefore, they had a lot more freedom to do a lot of the damage they did. Plus, they didn't have the social media and the communication systems and the mobile populations we've got. So we've got a few checks and balances that help us. Well, make no mistake, they're just as capable of being as brutal. But our ability to report and to broadcast and to network and the global society in some ways works against us, in other ways it can work for us. We've got to use all these methods. But we cannot let them continue to destroy the small businesses. They're trying to destroy the small farmer, the family businesses, the big companies, Macro, Pick and Pay, they're doing fine. And they're in bed with the Marxists anyway, and they're bailing them out. They'll never complain. You know, Anglo-American, so on, they completely worked out an arrangement at the top, and so they're not the problem. But it's all the normal people's lives are being destroyed and bankrupted. And that's exactly what communism wants. They want to make everyone dependent on the state. So you think under the Tsar, they had full employment, no inflation for decades, no inflation. But do you know why they had no inflation? Because they didn't charge interest to the banks. The banks weren't charging interest. So when you think of the whole system right now, it's rigged. We've got to get our people resisting the governments on every level. Of course, legal resistance, legal challenges, and so on. But these kind of things, saying to you've got to wear a mask all day long. Why? What on earth? Imagine how unhealthy we would be if we kept on breathing in unhealthy air. So this wearing a mask business, it's a muzzle. Yeah. You were going to ask.
Yeah, I was just saying the observation here is that the more the church is persecuted, it seems that they become much stronger.
They can.
At
great cost, but yes. Yes.
As against on the Western side where there's been
yes.
this consumerism, et cetera, the church becomes part of that.
Yeah. And it's not compromise is more dangerous, ultimately.
It's
dangerous.
Yes.
It's very dangerous.
Yeah. I think we can go to China and see how we use the church. He asked how much of communism helped them. Mm.
I had some friends in Poland writing me saying, this reminds me of the dark days when lockdown began. And I said, actually, this is worse than the dark days. We could still walk the dog and go to church in the dark days. This is unbelievable. By the way, in Poland, it's intriguing in Poland. Poland's the only country in the whole of Eastern Europe and the communists where the Protestant church were allowed to operate because it's such a Catholic country. They were cracking down the Catholics all the time. And they thought that, oh, some Baptists and so on would be a nice counterweight to the it aggravates the Catholics who are the real threat because Solidarity was Catholic and so on. So the Baptist churches in Poland had a lot more freedom than any other churches. Baptists were persecuted in Russia because they were a problem. They were persecuted in Romania because they were a problem. Baptists are left alone in Poland because in Poland the Catholics were the threat, not them. So the communists had different strategies in different places. And that also led to something else intriguing. They actually allowed a Bible society in Poland. Because they knew the Catholics don't want the people to have the Bible. So how about that for how their strategy was quite sharp? So our Baptist friends in Poland actually said we had more freedom in Poland under the communists than we've got now under the lockdown. So that's not representative of Eastern Europe, but that was just Poland. That was an interesting point. Other comments? Observations?
The space race. the Russians started it well.
Yes.
And I mean the communists. The
Bolsheviks. Yes.
They put the first person in space.
Sputnik.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then they also did the satellite station.
Okay, but you know where it all came from? It came from Peenemünde. Germany had the first rocket development, jets and rockets, and so the Soviets were supported all through the Second World War by Lend-Lease, paid for by South African gold. Thank you. And the Soviets at the end of the war were given everything they had to be able to take the whole of East Germany and the whole of Central Europe. Even though General Patton of the Americans said he could have got to Berlin long before them. He said, I could have gotten to Warsaw before Zhukov. But he was literally turned off the taps. No, Churchill and Franklin Delano Roosevelt have already agreed all that goes to the Soviets. That's behind the Soviet line. They're going to get everything before the Oder. So the Russians were allowed to take Peenemünde, the most advanced jet and space-based rocket station in the world. They got mountains, trainloads of patents and technology, and they looted all Germany's industries. They took over V1, V2 rockets and all of that over and were able to replicate. And it took thousands of German scientists over. Now, America took a couple of thousand German scientists, too, over to America. And so, as Bill Bethany used to say, when the Sputnik went up and the American Apollo went up and they met in outer space, they spoke to one another in German. Yes, they were both using captured scientists, you know. So the Soviets had quite a lot of advance, but it was looted technology.
And do you know about that book, I've forgotten who wrote it, Five Swimmers. They were Anglo-Boer soldiers, mm-hmm, that were in the camp here in the Greenpoint.
Oh, yes.
And they escaped. And they landed on a Russian ship in the harbor, and they were taken to Russia. And the Dutch ambassador gave them a place to stay in St. Petersburg, I think. And then eventually worked their way back to Europe and then in Southwest Africa, back on land,
sure,
joining the fighting forces.
That's a true story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go and look it up. It's a fantastic book.
There was also one of the interesting characters I read about in Anglo-Boer War. He was actually locked up in the castle, in the dungeon there where Keshwara had been locked up. And he escaped from the castle, and he ended up joining the German Secret Service in the First World War. He helped get the information that enabled them to know which ship that General Haig was, not General, General Kitchener was on. And he managed to get... Right, so he became known as the man who got Kitchener, because as revenge for the concentration camps, the Scorch Earth and Anglo-Boer War, managed to torpedo Kitchener, who was head of the British Army at that time. It was quite a big coup, 1916.
He was head of a Nazi ring in America.
Is that possible? Because now that's 40-something years later. Second World War II. Are you sure you're talking about the same person? How could he fight? He fought in the Anglo-Boer War, the First World War, and the Second?
He was a young child.
He must have been quite. He must have been quite old in the Second.
Hatred, you know, built up against the British.
Roynex. Yeah. The khakis. Any other comments?
I want to ask about the death of Stalin. How did he die?
Okay, what's quite interesting about the death of Stalin is that he had bullied and tormented his bodyguards that they were never to come in for any reason. Sometimes he would shout as though he's shouting for help, and they'd come in and order them executed because they shouldn't have, his order was don't come in. So when he was suffering a stroke, his bodyguards didn't come in because they didn't know if this was another trick. So he if medical help had come in, he might have survived. So they reckon he actually killed himself in the end by his stupid orders. And here's another intriguing thing, that none of the Politburo of the Soviet Union could walk into Stalin's office bedroom unannounced, unwelcomed, or in his dacha, I think, dacha, what they call it? His holiday home on the Black Sea? Dacha. But Armand Hammer from America, top capitalist, he could. he could fly his plane in direct into Moscow, drive straight over to Stalin's office in the Kremlin and walk straight in without an appointment. Now, there's so many things that come out from people like Professor Sutton's Best Enemy Money Can Buy, that these top capitalists in the West, he said, were completely, totally integrated at the top. He said there's no difference. Now, it's intriguing because I think a lot of hardcore communist revolutionaries on the ground would be very disconcerted if they realized that their leaders are in bed with the people they hate and who they think they're fighting with. But there's a lot of people on the free enterprise side who'd be pretty horrified to know also that a lot of the people who they think they're protecting are actually funding the very enemy who's and giving them what they need to kill them. That's, for example, just take us in our country. We had the Oppenheimer's. And Oppenheimer's boasted in 1995, op-ed piece of Daily Mail and the Star and so on, written by, who was it, Harry Oppenheimer, Ernst Oppenheimer? I think it was Ernst Oppenheimer then. He did the op-ed full page on the Star. This is what we've been working at since 1960, bringing the ANC to power. Nelson Mandela is present. This is what Anglo-Americans been dedicated to. We've been working behind the scenes, working with the ANC, cooperating. Now, this wasn't a conspiracy theory. This isn't something from Don McIlvaney or something. This is the Oppenheimer CEO of Anglo-American himself, Beers, saying, we were working for the last 35 years to subvert this government and bring an avowed Marxist to power. And there's worse than that you can get from the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, and the Armand Hammers over there in America. But just on our side, now that's just speaking about Oppenheimer. Then there's Anton Rupert. He's another story. He was also right on the other side helping the commies. If you drive to Franschhoek, you go past the...
Yes. Mm-hmm. And my mom bought shares in his tea company. And, you know, thinking it will help the Afrikaner. And, you know...
And Anton Rupert was working for the other side?
Yes.
You see, they're not free enterprise.
No.
They're no more than you know, a communist is a liberal or whatever. They're not free enterprise. They're for monopoly.
Monopoly capitalism is not free enterprise. Yes. That's why I don't like the term capitalist. Capitalist term that was coined by Marx. But Marx is a hypocrite anyway because he never worked a day in his life. In fact, Marx speculated on a stock exchange, gambled, and lived on inheritances and leached off richer relatives. He was not a worker, but that's typical. You know, if you want to see Karl Marx's grave in London, you've got to pay £10. £10 to see his grave. You go onto the Communist Party South Africa's website, and you can buy Lenin and Marx baseball caps, T-shirts, mugs, pens, and so on, credit cards accepted. I mean, these commies are complete hypocrites. But yes, these so-called capitalists at the top, they don't want free enterprise. In fact, you know why they prefer communism. Because under communism, there's no competition. They just have to pay off the dictator, whoever he may be, the Malema or the Mugabe or whatever, and they can do what they want. For example, in Rhodesia, we had a group called LONRO, London Rhodesia Company. Tiny Rowlands of LONRO. This man was totally into supporting a Mugabe, ZANU-PF member, and Mugabe would welcome him with open arms, and he had full access, and his farmers were really abused. I mean, that was the unacceptable face of capitalism. I don't think any of us at the time realized that the LONRO company was a bunch of communist criminal traitors. Yes, so we've got these traitors out there, and it's not just America.